Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of the Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on the public lands rule, where we'll discuss whether a new conservation and landscape health paradigm for federal lands will survive judicial review. Speaking on the panel today, we have Professor Sam Kalin, Jeff Wood, and Jonathan Wood. Jim Burling, the Vice President of Litigation at the Pacific Legal Foundation, will be moderating today. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Jim, thank you for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
So good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Federal Society seminar on conservation and the landscape health rule. This is a rule that BLM has adopted. Now, BLM, as many people know, is an arm of the federal government. Federal government owns approximately one third of the land in the country, and a substantial amount of that is run and managed by the Bureau of Land Management. These are lands that are not otherwise set aside for conservation purposes, national forests, national parks, wilderness areas, et cetera. Wildlife refuges, et cetera. So there has been a rule that has been going back and forth. In 2017, the Obama administration, toward the end of the administration, issued a rule dealing with trying to look at BLM lands from a conservation standpoint, and had the idea that lands would be leased for conservation purposes rather than simply leased for uses such as timber harvesting, mining, grazing, and that kind of economic use. The rule is quite controversial, and in 2018, at the beginning of the Trump administration, the Republican Congress overturned that rule in something called the Congressional Review Act, where it allows a Congress to overrule a rule that is promulgated by an administration if it's done within a certain myriad of time. And furthermore, the Congressional Review Act says the administration shall not be able to pass a substantially similar law. Well, now moving up to 2023, we have from the Biden administration, effective in June, the Conservation and Landscape Health Rule. We'll hear more about the details of that in a moment, but it does many of the same things the prior rule purported to do, which was to allow Bureau of Land Management unappropriated lands to be set aside for conservation purposes, leased for conservation purposes, so there could be habitat improvements and that kind of thing. It has proved to be wildly controversial. Just to give you a hint of how controversial, John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, says that the administration is allowing federal bureaucrats to destroy our way of life. Concern about what the impact will be on the ranching industry, the mining industry, the timber industry, and that kind of thing on Bureau of Land Management. As a result, there have been a series of lawsuits filed also in June, one by Utah and Wyoming, one by North Dakota, Idaho, and Montana, and one by a consortium of 12 or so resource groups, American Farm Bureau Federation, et cetera, et cetera. And they have certain charges, and their claims are that the Conservation and Landscape Health Rule violates the Federal Land Policy and Management Act because it has properties leased for non-use rather than use. There is a concern that it violates the Mineral Leasing Act. There is a concern that it did not have analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act. The administration said it was subject to a categorical exclusion to that act. Others say differently. It's a claim that it's a multi-pronged attack on oil and gas leasing. It's unlawful attempts to regulate greenhouse gases. It violates the It violates the Congressional Review Act because it is substantially the same as the rule that was struck down in 2017. It's arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the complaints go on and on. So today we have a distinguished panel to discuss the rule and the litigation in response, and we have people that will think the rule is a pretty good idea from a conservation standpoint, and others who think that the rule is going to have an adverse impact on, as Barrasso said, the way of life of Westerners. So first we have Professor Callan, who is a visiting professor from the University of Colorado of Law, School of Law, this fall. He's also the William T. Schwartz Distinguished Professor at Law, Associate Dean, and a co-director of the Gina Guy Center for Law and Water at the University of Wyoming College of Law, and an adjunct faculty at the Haupt School of the Environmental and Natural Resources. He also, I understand, is going to be in Bloomington this fall as well. He was a solicitor during the Clinton administration and practiced law in Washington, D.C. for many years. We also have Jeff Woods. Jeff is the chair of Baker Botts, the D.C. environmental section, and also serves as chair of the Federalist Society's Environmental and Property Rights Practice Group. In his 21 years of law practice, Jeff has served as the acting assistant attorney general for the Justice Department's Environment and Natural Resources Division during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And lastly, we have Jonathan Wood. He's a vice president of law and public policy at PERC. As an attorney, Jonathan litigated environmental and property right cases in the Supreme Court of the United States, federal and state appellate courts, and trial courts across the country. His writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, National Review, Reason, and other outlets, as his research has been published in journals such as the Environmental Law Reporter, Yale Journal of Regulation, Notice and Comment, Pace and Environmental Law Review, and the California Western Law Review. Prior coming to PERC, Jonathan was a senior attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation, where he litigated cases concerning the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, and other federal environmental laws. He was co-counsel for the Forest Landowners and Weyerhaeuser Company versus U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in which the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that private land could not be used to arbitrarily be regulated as critical habitat under the Endangered Species Act. I am James Burling. I am the Vice President for Legal Affairs at Pacific Legal Foundation, and I have been with Pacific Legal Foundation litigating environmental and property right cases for roughly the last 41 years. So now I will turn it over to Professor Callan, who will give us some of the background on public land management, the Federal Land Policy Management Act, and the new rule. Professor Callan, take it away.
Thanks, Jim, and welcome, everybody. You know, when we take a look at this rule, I think one of the principal issues, and Jim explained that there are a lot of questions and claims involving litigation of the rule, but one of the principal questions is how to apply FLTMA's multiple use mandate and what type of flexibility does the agency enjoy when it manages, and we're really talking about now, there are 441 million acres of multiple use land split between the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, with roughly a little bit over 245 million acres that are managed by the Bureau of Land Management. And about 90% right now of that acreage is open to oil and gas development, and grazing is reportedly allowed on roughly about 155 million acres, with another 1 million acres available for hard rock minerals. But before we get into the specifics of the rule, it's worth briefly reviewing how this rule is an extension of some prior efforts that really began in the 1990s. And it starts roughly around the time that President Clinton designated about 1.7 million acres of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and the principal decision to have the Bureau of Land Management administer that monument, if you will. And the reason that it was done was there was really a decided shift by the administration to shift the BLM toward a more appreciative role in managing lands for something other than simply extractive uses. This was then followed by Secretary Babbitt's effort to establish a National Landscape Conservation Program with Congress in 2009, codifying the effort through the National Landscape Conservation System and having BLM administer the program, and I quote, to conserve, protect, and restore nationally significant landscapes that have outstanding cultural, ecological, and scientific values for the benefit of current and future generations. That is effectively for sustainability and then ultimately for resilience. And then during the Obama administration, we all know that the BLM was afforded administrative control over the Bears Ears National Monument as well. So the idea of ensuring sustainable ecosystems is based into modern public land management programs in several ways. And it dates back many decades. And it becomes evident in two ways. The first is the shift that Congress demanded of the agencies to engage in planning. And that means examining the appropriate uses, including conservation of landscapes. In the Federal Land Policy Management Act, and we'll typically probably throughout this session call it FLIPMA, Congress indicated that resources should be periodically and systematically inventoried to ensure that both their present and future use is protected through a land use planning process. And then the statute included land use planning provisions and an authorization for rulemakings. And Congress further noted that the BLM would be afforded discretionary authority and could establish, in its words, comprehensive rules. Obviously, rules like the one that we're going to be talking about. And when directing that the secretary inventory public lands, Congress instructed that the outdoor recreation and scenic values be included with a priority also given to what we call areas of critical environmental concern, or ACECs. The second is that recognition of sustainability, ensuring the protection of sustainable ecosystems. And one can look at what had happened right before the passage of FLIPMA in the mid-1970s at statutes like the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act, where the ideas of sustainability and ecosystem protection had become part of, if you will, the congressional mandate. But for BLM lands, it really dates back arguably to the Tailored Grazing Act and a recognition that we need to begin to plan to protect landscapes. That was then carried through in both the Forest Systems Statutes as well as in the Federal Land Policy Management Act. The Federal Land Policy Management Act was a fairly comprehensive statute that was passed in the mid-1970s following the development of a public land law review commission to take a look at how we are going to look at developing an organic statute for effectively the Bureau of Land Management. And it basically preceded a number of studies that really were attempting to take a look at better ways to plan for the management of our public lands. And any suggestion, at least today, I think, that the conservation was not a contemplated use is belied by the congressional declaration that, and I quote, the public lands be managed in a manner that will protect the quality of the scenic, scientific, scenic, historic, ecological, environmental, air and atmospheric, water resources and archaeological values. That where appropriate will preserve and protect certain public lands in their natural condition, along with providing for outdoor recreation and human occupancy. And this declaration was followed by a declared policy of adopting regulations for protecting, fairly quickly, it even said, areas of critical environmental concern. By contrast, when Congress talked about extractive uses, all it said is that in the management of the public lands, those uses should be recognized as they may relate to the nation's needs for particular resources. And perhaps even more significantly, the congressional definition for multiple use specifically includes avoiding permanent impairment of the landscape and resources today and into the future. So with that, let's now take a look at really briefly, and I only have a few minutes to basically highlight some of the critical aspects of the rule. First, it's designed to ensure that land use planning, which I had just talked about, embodies the principles of ecosystem resilience, which, according to the administration, is particularly important according to the effects that we're now witnessing on our public lands from climate change. And this might mean developing standards for all public lands during the planning process to assess land health. So one critical aspect of the role is to develop these type of land health standards. Second, and this is where most of the dialogue really focuses, is that it provides for non-use values or conservation. And that conservation is a value that will be on par with other use values such as mining, timber harvesting, or grazing. Conservation then becomes explicitly acknowledged as a use under the multiple use mandate along with the other uses. Third, as a tool for conservation, the rule offers opportunities for mitigation and restoration leasing, and allows for mitigation banks as well. And as part of mitigation, the rule also employs the traditional mitigation hierarchy that we saw emerge a long time ago in the wetlands program of first avoiding, then minimizing, and then mitigating any adverse impacts. Fourth, the rule provides for identifying quote unquote intact landscapes and areas where habitat connectivity is appropriate, and then also allowing those identified areas to be managed for protection. And then fifth, the rule elevates the importance and the ability to designate areas of critical environmental concern. And there's been a considerable amount of interest over at least the last decade to have the department do more about assessing whether to designate ACECs and then also to so designate them. And one can take a look at some of the recent debates in the last couple of months about the land use plans here in Wyoming as elsewhere in the Rockies, where the administration has begun to focus a little bit more on the use of these ACECs. So along a similar vein, the rule also applies FLTMA's overriding standard of insuring against unnecessary and undue degradation of public lands, a standard that had previously been defined for mining activities and now that has been applied and defined for all other type of activities. And the rule explicitly recognizes the importance of indigenous ecological knowledge. But with all that said, there are some important caveats. The rule does not affect any valid existing rights, and the administration made it clear that it was not intending to affect recreation and that you can have sustainable recreation considered as a compatible conservation use. So I think with that, we can probably move on.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Jim, you're muted.
Sorry about that. Let's turn next to Jeffrey Wood, who will talk more about the lawsuits and the various causes of action. Jeffrey, take it away.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Sam. It's good to be on another panel with you. And Jonathan Wood, great to be with you as well. No relation for those watching, although a good brotherly fight was always fun to watch. So maybe we can keep it interesting, Jonathan. First, I should be clear that I'm speaking here on my own behalf and not on behalf of any organization or my firm or any clients, just sharing my own views on this important topic. And I thought, like Sam, I would begin with a little bit of a history tour, because I do think it's important to understand the context in which this particular rulemaking arose. Sam talked about the policy origins. I want to talk briefly about the scientific origins that led to the kind of activities in the 90s that Sam mentioned. In 1992, a research paper titled The Concept of Landscape Health was published, and it introduced this general concept with a focus on landscape management that accommodates human uses that does not, quote, in the words of the article, does not, quote, tip a healthy landscape out of its homeostatic equilibrium. A few years later, in 1998, another study was published entitled Evaluating Landscape Health that also discussed the objectives of a landscape management approach as being geared towards, quote, satisfying present societal goals and to ensure the flow of ecosystem goods and services for future generations. Then in the late 1990s, you have Secretary Babbitt, who adopts kind of consistent with this approach, a new suite of rules. One of those was new rules governing livestock grazing on public lands. This included a regulation concerning the issuance of permits for conservation use, in addition to permits for the grazing of livestock. And it was actually referred to in the litigation that resulted from that rulemaking as the, quote, conservation use rule, a rule very similar to the original title of this rule, Conservation and Landscape Health Rule. That ultimately resulted in a decision by the 10th Circuit in 1999 called Public Lands Council versus Babbitt. It's found at 167 F3rd 1287. That decision reviewed a district court, a decision that struck down the conservation use rule. And ultimately, the 10th Circuit affirmed that part of the district court decision, invalidating the conservation rule portion of the regulations, although there are other portions of the rulemaking suite that were upheld by the 10th Circuit. And I mentioned that because in this context, many have raised concerns, I think fair concerns, that some of the notions or principles that are found in this latest attempt have their roots in the same sort of approaches that were taken back then. And that were taken again, as everyone knows, during the Obama administration's Planning 2.0 effort in 2016, that also focused on landscape scale approaches. And that was torpedoed by a Congressional Review Act measure in Congress in 2017 in the early days of the Trump administration. And so, of course, this time around, the administration, the Biden administration was able to avoid, it appears, the CRA threat by getting the public lands rule finalized before the summer. According to the Congressional Research Service, the current CRA deadline, although it's not necessarily altogether settled at this point, but the current CRA look back period is probably around August 1st. And so because this rule was finalized before that, it may very well escape CRA scrutiny in the next Congress. I mean, looking back a little bit more at the history as well, there were additional research and proposed rules over the last decade or so. But then ultimately, President Biden issued a directive at the outset of his administration calling on the Interior Department to use, quote, landscape scale, science-based collaborative approaches for natural resource management. Question whether much of that is grounded in statute as much as it is in policy preferences. And I think that's a big piece of the litigation that we're seeing today. Jim mentioned this at the outset, but how big is this rule? It applies to all 245 million acres of public lands under BLM management. One-tenth of the entire land area of the United States is at least in some way impacted by the framework that's put in place by this rule. The stated purpose of the rule is to establish a policy to do something quite grand in their mind, build and maintain the resilience of legal systems on public lands, seeking to protect the most intact functioning landscapes, and doing a host of other conservation purposes, which may very well be laudable and worthwhile efforts. But many questions have been raised about the statutory basis of it. Stated a bit differently, BLM says the goal of the rule is to provide a decision support and prioritization framework for BLM as it seeks to identify where conservation protection is appropriate. So this is a major regulation, significant national implications, especially in the Western United States, and engendered significant lawsuits almost right away. As Jim mentioned, several lawsuits were filed by states as well as by industry coalitions, and those are now pending. I wanted to, because we have limited time and because the focus of the litigation, I think, is now turned primarily to the Utah case, I wanted to focus on that one. Utah's lawsuit was assigned to Judge Barlow. Another separate case filed in Utah by the industry coalition was assigned to a different judge. And just yesterday, the Justice Department and the industry plaintiffs in that second case jointly moved to transfer and reassign that case to the Utah state challenge that's being heard by Judge Barlow. That was the lower numbered case and would expect that the cases get consolidated there. And in the Utah challenge, which was filed originally back on July 11th, the states did seek to stay the rule either by motion for a stay or for a preliminary injunction. And that is now briefed up and pending. The state's focus, even though there are a long list of potential legal flaws that could be argued about in that context, they focus the stay effort on the NEPA violations, namely that BLM failed to comply with the procedural requirements of NEPA when adopting the public land rule, and that NEPA requires federal agencies to consider the environmental impacts of, quote, major federal actions, and that this regulation would, in their view, easily satisfy that test for being a major federal action as defined in the CEQ regulations. CEQ's regulations specifically give, quote, the adoption of official policy such as rules and regulations as constituting major federal actions and would presumably require an environmental impact statement or at a minimum an environmental assessment before adopting a rule of this nature. But they did not follow that process. BLM instead relied on a, quote, categorical exclusion. And the exclusion they relied on is one that provides for a NEPA exclusion for administrative, financial, legal, technical, or procedural activities of agencies. It's usually been interpreted fairly narrowly, and they obviously BLM relies on that here. The states question whether this is in fact a mere administrative or financial, legal, technical, or procedural rule. And I would say the states seem to have the better of that argument, it seems to me. BLM does not rely on that piece of the categorical exclusion alone, perhaps wisely so. They have also argued that NEPA was not triggered here because the rules, quote, environmental effects are too broad, speculative, or conjectural to lend themselves to meaningful analysis. That's being hashed out in the litigation as well, both sides putting forth their arguments. The states respond that obviously BLM can assess those environmental effects and that BLM is out there touting the rule based on its ability to achieve certain environmental objectives. And so countering the notion that the environmental effects are too speculative to assess. I think it's a closer call on that one than the first argument. But I think the states have largely shown that not only are the effects knowable in that context, but they could have been evaluated in some way. The last piece I'll just mention briefly is that the plaintiffs have argued that even if a categorical exclusion was applicable, there are no extraordinary circumstances. Or I'm sorry, there are extraordinary circumstances associated with the public lands rule that would require compliance with NEPA. And they're obviously debating that point now. And then briefly, just a final minute or two, beyond the NEPA claim that's front and center in the pending state dispute, there are other key issues and concerns that have been raised in the litigation, primarily those being raised by the industry challengers. First, in response to BLM's position that they're simply putting conservation on equal footing, litigants have challenged that notion that in fact the public lands rule is elevating conservation use above other uses. And then some have also claimed, and I think this is certainly worth raising and potentially going to be accepted by the courts, that this public lands rule is built on the same foundation and adopts similar themes and perspectives and procedures as the Planning 2.0 rule that we've already talked about. So that's one of the claims that's been raised in the litigation will certainly get some attention. And then obviously the biggest question is, is there a statutory basis for treating conservation uses the same way as other uses in this particular way and with this framework, and whether they're stretching the statutory provisions too far. BLM takes a position that FLTMA provides them with broad authority to issue leases for restoration and mitigation purposes writ large, and they base it on statutory text that allows BLM to issue leases for the, quote, use, occupancy, and development of public lands. And I think Sam was getting at this a bit when he talked about non-use values as being the focus of this rule. The key term there in the statute is use, occupancy, and development of the public lands, and doesn't seem to clearly embody the kinds of far-reaching, broad-based conservation uses that are elevated in this new rule. So I'll pause there. There's obviously more we could talk about, but I want to turn the floor over now to Jonathan.
So Jonathan will talk from the perspective of the his group PERC. There's just an editorial in the New York Times a day or so ago about that issue, and it's front and center. So Jonathan, take it away, and you'll explain from his standpoint and from the standpoint of the Public Economy Research Center why this rule perhaps is a step in the right direction for conservation.
Well, thanks, Jim, and thanks, Sam and Jeff, for the earlier remarks. I'm going to focus on what I see as the most novel part of the rule and the biggest legal questions in the case, which concern whether conservation is a valid use of federal land and the restoration mitigation leasing structure that's created by the rule. But I'll follow the precedent of Sam and Jeff and start with a little bit of history. If Sam focused on the policy, Jeff focused on the law, I might focus on the practice. For decades, use of federal land has been a persistent source of conflict with repeated litigation between environmental groups and land users, whether those are grazers, oil and gas developers, or other users, over whether a particular use is consistent with FLTMA, NEPA, ESA, et cetera. That status quo hasn't been particularly good for anyone. From the perspective of a rancher, and grazing is the most common use of BLM lands, this litigation has undermined the certainty of their ability to graze and jeopardized their businesses, and also lowered the value of the private land that they own neighboring their grazing allotments. But for conservation groups, it also hasn't done much good either, because it's process-based litigation. And at the end of the day, groups eventually came to see that they were spending a lot of money and building a lot of ill will without changing all that much on the ground. And so over the last couple of decades, some conservation groups, certainly not all, have looked to instead work with existing users to find ways to resolve conflicts through markets. That's primarily been done through things like buyouts. So if someone has a sheep grazing lease in an area where there are wild sheep and risks of disease transmission, conservation groups have worked with those ranchers to either retire those grazing allotments or convert them from sheep to another species that wouldn't pose that environmental risk. PERC has done some of this work, working with ranchers in Southwest Montana to change grazing practices to reduce conflicts with grizzlies, because whenever there's a conflict between grizzly bears and livestock, that usually results in the grizzly bears being shot. We wanted to reduce that. But the problem is that there is no formal mechanism to have any of those contracts. They're sort of negotiated in the shadow of the law because there's no way to formalize them and get recognition from the agency that they are valid. So for the last couple of years, PERC and others have been working on how to operationalize a system to facilitate that. It is largely modeled on programs that exist at the state level to manage state trust lands, including in states that are challenging this rule. So Idaho, Utah, and many other states resolve conflicts over state land by allowing conservation groups and other users to essentially compete with each other in the market for whether land's going to be used one way or another. And so I see the rule as a step in the direction of using markets rather than politics to resolve some of these conflicts. I often say that if we decide the use of these lands through politics in the first instance, they will ultimately be decided by a court. And this is a way to potentially move away from that. Now, on to the legal question. So I think the big legal question, the one that would have the largest repercussions, is the question of whether conservation is a valid use under FLTMA. Fortunately, I think this is actually a pretty easy question if we look at the text. So as Jeff mentioned, the statute authorizes BLM to regulate the, quote, use, occupancy, and development of the public lands. It does not provide any further limitation, doesn't identify specific uses. It doesn't provide a standard for excluding and including different uses. It is just the broader term use. I think it's also important to note that it talks about use of land as opposed to use of every resource on that land. And often when I hear people criticizing the rule as embracing non-use, I think they're making that mistake, that because a use for conservation might mean you don't use oil and gas resources, some other resource on the land, doesn't mean you're not using the land itself. And in fact, FLTMA again expressly endorses this view, defining multiple use in a way that provides for less than maximal use of resources on that land, while still recognizing that the land is being used. And it also defines multiple use to include conservation values. We also have some precedent that's relevant to this question. Jeff mentioned one of the cases out of the 10th Circuit Public Lands Council. In that case, conservation uses were being authorized under a different statute, the Taylor Grazing Act, which uses totally different language. So it authorizes the use of land for grazing. And the 10th Circuit, I think, correctly said, well, if the authority is about grazing, a permit that says you cannot graze here, which is what those conservation leases did in that case, doesn't qualify. But again, like, this isn't under the Taylor Grazing Act, it's under FLTMA, which uses much broader language. So I think the right precedent to look to for this case is a much earlier decision from the Supreme Court called Grimaud, which was a challenge to the Forest Service's establishment of a leasing program for grazing on forest lands, something that was not mentioned in the statute, probably not anticipated by Congress, which is thinking more about timber development and water. But when that authority, program was challenged in 1911, the Supreme Court said the language is use. It is broad. Congress couldn't have anticipated every future use of this land, hundreds of millions of acres over decades. And so we're going to apply the text and say that this is a valid program. The language in that case was virtually identical to the language in FLTMA, and so I think justifies the exact same conclusion. But beyond the text, there's also a statute, separation of powers objection to conservation use, mostly framed as a major questions concern. Again, this too was answered by Grimaud, which considered a non-delegation challenge to that authority, the idea that you can't have a leasing program for particular use unless Congress has spelled that out. The Supreme Court said no, one, again, based on the text, but also based on the fact this was an Article 4 power, not an Article 1 power, and we don't yet have a lot of major questions, doctrine cases about Article 4, so that's going to be questions going to be resolved in this case. But I think the bigger concern I have with major questions doctrine is that I see the argument as turning the doctrine on its head. If the BLM here were asserting the power to interpret use to categorically exclude particular uses, that is what would raise a major questions doctrine. As far as I know, there is no precedent for the BLM ever asserting that authority. There's no text in the statute that authorizes it or would guide the exercise of that authority. And so I think really the major questions doctrine is a problem for the challengers to overcome here, because really what they're trying to say is that BLM should be interpreting FLTMA to exclude uses that are otherwise not excluded by the text. And in the last few minutes, I'll move on to some of the challenges to the actual leasing program that's been established to facilitate this conservation use. Again, as a textual matter, it's pretty easy because the language in FLTMA says that if it's a use, you can regulate it through leases. So the earlier question sort of implies the second. But this is where we get into some of the really specific claims. So like NEPA concerns that Jeff was addressing. It's sort of funny that the arguments being asserted by Utah and Wyoming were developed initially during the Trump administration by some litigious environmental groups that were trying to overturn some of the regulatory reforms during that administration. So we sort of had some folks switch sides of the table on this issue. But ultimately, I think the NEPA claim should fail because of the uncertainty of the effects here. It's really tough to imagine what a NEPA analysis would look like to satisfy Utah and Wyoming in this case. Because again, we don't know how many restoration mitigation leases might be issued, where they might be issued, what kind of activities it might involve, when they might be issued. There's really nothing of substance yet to meaningfully analyze and produce anything that would actually inform the public or the agency. And ordinarily, when that happens, what we do is instead do project-level NEPA, which BLM acknowledges it may have to do here, depending on the activities involved in a particular lease. And so this isn't an end run around NEPA. I would instead characterize it as similar to what the previous administration did, applying NEPA at the appropriate point. The Congressional Review Act has also been implicated here, although, again, I'm not sure it applies. So the language about prohibiting substantially similar rules is a scalpel, not a sledgehammer. While there are some similarities between this rule overall and the Planning 2.0 rule, the earlier rule did not have anything about conservation being used or conservation leasing program. So even if there were a CRA issue here, the result should be to remove the the commonalities between the two rules, as opposed to a broad relief against the entire rule, which is what the industry petitioners are seeking. With that, I'll turn it back and look forward to our further debate and questions.
All right. So participants, people that are watching this, if you have any questions, there is a Q&A box in the lower part of your screen. Please put your questions into there so we can get to those and answer those. But at this point, I'd like to give the other panelists the opportunity to comment on some of the remarks that have been made by the other panelists. Hopefully you can disagree and have some fur fly, if you will. I'll start with Sam. Do you have any comments you'd like to make on the other panelists?
I would just echo first what Jonathan just said in terms of NEPA. Obviously, that's going to be a critical issue. One thing to think about is that this rule is going to operate at a planning level, not necessarily only at a specific activity level. And so there will be opportunities for those who are concerned about the application of NEPA. You know, at the planning level, the agencies will be able to, and this is where most of the issues really surface, they will be able to participate in that planning process. The National Environmental Policy Act will kick in during that planning process. So if, in fact, you know, there's going to be determinations about areas that might be available for conservation or, you know, uses like a mitigation or a restoration lease, I think that that's partly where those issues will get raised. I think that folks are correct that, you know, one of the critical issues will be whether or not conservation use is a valid use under multiple use language. But I think if you take a look at a lot of the history, if you look at the structure of FLIPA, if you look at the animating causes for why Congress had to pass FLIPA, if you look at sort of the history, the evolution of how we look at managing lands, the importance of ecosystems that began to emerge from the 1970s on about how there's a need for landscape level planning and ensuring landscape health. That's what's driving a lot of this rule. And I don't think that that is in any way contrary to any multiple use standard. So I'll leave it at that.
All right. Thank you. And Jeffrey Wood, comments on the other participants of the panel?
Yeah, I think I just want to take a step back for a moment and in response to those particular thoughts on conservation as a proper use under the FLIPMA multi-use framework. This is not just a rule about a typical normal use based on conservation. This is about an incredible infusion of conservation and landscape-based principles into the entire planning process across 10% of lands in the United States. I mean, it is an enormous undertaking. If you look at what the rule is intended to do, the main components of it, it's protecting intact landscapes, establishing procedures for managing landscapes, for wildlife habitat, for water quality preservation and the like, expanding opportunities for designating areas of critical environmental concern, protecting and managing landscapes for natural, cultural, scientific, and other values, establishing an entirely new program for restoration and mitigation leases that Jonathan has talked so much about, non-statutory mechanisms adopted by agencies without some clear legal authority. And again, I think a little point that's been raised in the litigation that is probably worth considering is whether that enough attention has been given to the creation of that new program to the other existing uses of these lands, and whether adequate notice would be provided to those current uses and maybe potential future productive uses of those areas in the implementation of the conservation leasing program. And then there's also additional efforts established through the rule for decision-making processes and incorporation of science and the like. So I think it's an incredibly broad, pervasive, new approach that departs from the kind of more equivalent or modest kinds of conservation planning that had been preceding it. I do want to go back to the statutory text of FLIPMA, because I do think the litigation, as so far the substantive challenges are concerned, hinges very much on the text that is in FLIPMA. And again, we've talked about Section 302B and its language using the phrase use, occupancy, and development. of the public lands, which certainly on its own would seem to suggest, if you read it in context, more focus on active use than on conservation use. But if you read the rest of the language in the statute that follows that clause, I think it reinforces that point even more. It says, including, but not limited to, long-term leases to permit individuals to utilize public lands for habitation, cultivation, and the development of small trade or manufacturing concerns. So we don't see anything in that about the kinds of extensive conservation use that's contemplated here. And then if you go beyond that to other parts of the statute, you also see cold water being poured on the notion that a broad based of conservation use is within the meaning of use in FLTMA. For example, section 103 of FLTMA defines principal or major use to include domestic livestock grazing, fish and wildlife development, utilization, mineral exploration and production, rights of way, outdoor recreation, and timber production, but doesn't say the kinds of uses that we're contemplating here in this public lands rule. And there are other places we can look at in the statute. I'm not trying to argue, and I don't think anyone is necessarily arguing that conservation can't be a piece of the multiple use framework, but the kind of elevation of use above other potential productive uses is, I think, at the core of what many find to be problematic here. And the fact that this would be done as a matter of regulatory action without clear statutory authority raises concerns about who's in charge of making decisions about public lands. Is it Congress under the Constitution, or is it the agency that's going to exercise this without clear congressional authority, especially against a backdrop where Congress has already decided in multiple settings that this kind of conduct was, or this kind of approach was not what Congress was intending to happen. So I'll stop there and we can go to more questions.
Right. And I'll give Jonathan a chance to have a final word on that before we go to questions. And the attendees in this panel, please put your questions in the Q&A below so we can answer whatever questions you might have. But Jonathan, what are your comments on the prior panelists?
Yeah, I want to start by saying Jeff is absolutely right that this is a very big rule is too much for us to cover completely in this amount of time. And so, my remarks focused on the restoration mitigation lease and conservation as a use, but Jeff is absolutely right that conservation comes up in many of the other changes to the planning process, which raise their own unique legal issues that I hope we'll be able to get into more in the questions. And I'm personally going to punt any of those things to Sam. But on the whether conservation is a use question, I think it just bears emphasis that the language in the text is broad. Whenever specific types of uses are referenced, they're referenced in an inclusive rather than exclusive way. So it's always including but not limited to particular types of uses. The definition of multiple use expressly contemplates conservation uses. And the rule is designed to try to avoid the kinds of direct conflicts between competing uses that many of the industry groups are most concerned about. So it's written to preclude the establishment of a restoration mitigation lease in an area that would conflict with existing valid leases, rights, or privileges, as Sam was mentioning earlier. But it also has a provision saying is one of the factors for granting one of these leases is whether the proposed conservation use is consistent with and supported by the local community, other neighboring users. The officials at the Bureau of Land Management have indicated that the purpose of this was to encourage the kind of collaborative solutions that I was talking about earlier, where rather than suing each other, conservation groups work with existing users to find ways to accommodate both interests. And so there are mechanisms put into the rule to try to discourage that direct scorched earth conflict and address the concern that it's elevating conservation over everything else.
So one of the comments that I've often seen about this, and if you look at the industry lawsuits, there's a series of comments by the players and comments like this from the American Farm Bureau Federation, Zipi Duval, quote, further restricting grazing on public lands takes us backward, not forward, because ranchers are delivering a return on the trust placed in them to take care of the public lands. And there seems to be pervasive throughout these comments from a variety of industry groups of an attempt to get rid of grazing. Now, Jonathan just spoke about the fact that the conservation leases are supposed to be compatible with, not restrictive of zone of existing grazing leases, mineral leases, or what have you. But there seems to be an extraordinary level of distrust from the industry groups about what this rule will actually accomplish and whether it will actually, in fact, restrict grazing sometime, if not immediately, sometime down the road as it is implemented further. Would any of you like to comment on that level of distrust among the ranching, grazing, and farming industry?
Can I just make one observation? The landscape health aspects of this rule are taken from the grazing program. And so if you take a look at what the administration is trying to do in this rule, it's trying to take principles that it's learned and try to employ in the context of grazing and expand those, and to also make sure that those landscape health standards are actually adequately examined through, I think Jeff looked at this, looking at water quality and things like that. So I'm not sure that it's really targeting, if you will, grazing, but that's the way I sort of would examine it.
Any further responses?
Yeah, I'll just jump in to express some qualified sympathy for that perspective. FERC does a lot of work with ranchers, including ranchers that work on federal land, and they've expressed a lot of frustration with some of these market tools because they perceive it as the last step in a process that begins with litigation and regulatory restraints that erode their permits and give them no choice but to do a buyout or some other, take whatever they can get at the last end. So there are definitely other policies that need to be addressed. Like, this is not a one-size-fix-all. For instance, there are existing policies that impose use it or lose it requirements on ranchers that give them very little flexibility to manage their operations in a way that's good for the land and good for their businesses. But the problems of those other policies aren't a reason to attack this one. There's a reason to address those fundamental policy problems.
So we have, go ahead.
I was just going to observe that I think the concern, as I understand it, from the grazing community is just that this is another effort to entrust agencies with greater flexibility and discretion to manage and make decisions that may or may not be in their interest, but that they will feel like they have very little control over. Grazing is a significant industry. They've got significant investments in there in what they're doing, and to have a entirely new regime created through the agencies without some clear expression in law and without clear protections for the variety of other productive uses that are out there, I think raises significant concerns, and is why there's such a large coalition of farming groups and national cattlemen and others have rallied together to oppose this this rule in litigation.
So we have a question that came in from an anonymous attendee. Perhaps Jonathan could speak to the premise that restoration or mitigation is a non-use or non-productive use. To the contrary, the attendee says, isn't there a lot of economic benefit behind that type of use, in which restoration is very active in nature and in fact could facilitate through mitigation offsets more traditional consumptive uses? Jonathan?
Yeah, absolutely. If we think about this question in the private context, I think it's a relatively easy one. Lots of private landowners use their land to maximize environmental benefits. They might restore streams to improve a fishery or promote native plants to attract wildlife. All of that is use of that land. No one would think they're banning the land by elevating environmental considerations. And I think we should think about use on federal land the exact same way. There is a difference between use or non-use of a particular resource, which is what I think people are actually arguing when they talk about non-use, versus use or non-use of the land. Non-use is abandonment of the land. It's not caring for the land or caring about the consequences for it. And the activities that will be done under restoration leases are not that. They have to have a particular environmental value in mind and set out the things that the permittee or the lessee are going to do to bring it about. So that might be restoring a or addressing an abandoned mine to improve watershed health and promote fisheries. It might mean something like what we're looking at is converting barbed wire fencing to wildlife-friendly fencing or virtual fencing, things that can be both good for other users and for wildlife or other environmental values, but do require effort. They do involve use. It's just a different type of use or a less intensive use than others.
Any comments from the other panelists on that? So let's go to another question. Tony Woodliffe writes, it seems that DOI's Department of Interior's assertion that restoration is implied by conservation is a problem, given that in practice we've seen its sub-agencies use restoration as a pretext for more expansive seizures of water and land, removing land from use, et cetera. On top of that, restoration opens the door to nebulous claims about what supposed prior state the land is to be restored to. So it seems those questions reflect the lack of trust that I mentioned earlier. Anybody like to comment on that?
Yeah, Jim, I would just jump in and say, I think one of the complaints that ties to that is the lack of clarity in the rule about key terms. I think in the comment process, there was a lot of commenters who complained that there's terminology throughout the rule that's very vague and broad and ill-defined. What is intended by restoration? What's intended by mitigation? What kinds of activities qualify for it? And how much discretion is given to the agencies to decide how this is going to work out? And I don't think the final rule actually provides enough clarity on exactly how this will work out with all the necessary details, both from a substantive leasing standpoint, but also from the standpoint of the process and public input and effects on other activities to give the kind of comfort that stakeholders need to feel like this is going to be a reliable, fair, transparent process that won't upset the multiple use sustained yield framework that has grown up over decades.
We had a question that came in previously about wild horses. To what extent could this rule be utilized for protecting wild horses? That's been a highly controversial issue for decades. Is there anything that could be used in this rule to address that? Anybody like to comment on that?
I mean, I guess I would. Oh, sorry. Were you going to say something, Jeff?
No, I was going to defer to you on that one.
Oh, I mean, I think that this rule probably has zero impact on the Wild Horses and Burros program. That program as a unique program, we see a lot of litigation, obviously, in the Rockies, maybe going down to the Nevada on the Wild Horses and Burros program. So I don't think that this rule, the way it's going to operate, would intrude in any way in the way in which the existing implementation of the Wild Horses and Burros program has been operated. And those litigation claims are separate and apart from any of the issues that we're seeing in this case.
So we have one final question, and then I'd like to give the panelists an opportunity to recap. The final question is, it appears that climate change and endangered species are the basis of that. And I think what the questioner is getting at is that we have gone on for a very long time worrying about climate change or protection of endangered species, and our ability to confront those things seems to be limited. And perhaps this rule is another tool in the to confront climate change and the lack of progress sometimes in restoring endangered species.
I mean, I think the answer is that, you know, I've written on climate change's impact on public lands and resources. There's no doubt that it's having a huge impact. One can take a look at, you know, the Joshua tree and what might happen to Joshua tree. But I don't think this rule, and Jeff, you may have a different perspective, is necessarily driven solely by climate change. It's driven, or concerns about climate change. It's driven by the effects of climate change on habitat fragmentation. It's driven in part by the need for landscape level planning as a consequence of the effects of climate change on wildlife, on the effects of water and the availability of water and when it comes down in terms of our public lands. So I think it's a lot different than that. I think that, you know, while it may, climate change obviously presents issues that are of urgency for our public lands and resources, I think this rule is based on something broader than that.
Right. Yeah, let's have an opportunity. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, I think I would agree with Sam on that point generally, that this is broader than those two concerns. It is more about a three-decade effort to reform the land management program to more fully incorporate broad notions of landscape health and conservation generally. But I do think it runs headlong into some of the most contentious issues out west involving species management and risks potentially upsetting some of the delicate balances that have been achieved on managing species and on western lands.
Thank you, Jeffrey. We're nearly out of time. I'd like to give an opportunity for the panelists to have any final thoughts they might have before we turn it back to the FedSoc.
I think we have agreement that conservation is a use, that it's okay to be on par with other uses, but the question is going to be whether or not this elevates conservation over other uses.
Jeffrey Wood?
Yeah, no, thank you, Sam. It's always great to be with you and Jonathan and Jim. Thank you for this. And thanks, FedSoc, for hosting it. The litigation is ongoing. I think there will be significant developments over the next couple of months. Certainly, ultimately, the outcome of this whole effort probably hinges, like many things, on the outcome of the election and the extent to which this program and the new changes actually get implemented in the years ahead.
And finally, Jonathan Wood.
Yeah, I'll echo that. Thanks to FedSoc for hosting this debate and for all of you for the pleasant conversation. I think also following up on Jeff's point, regardless of the outcome of the litigation or the election, like implementation of this rule is going to matter. It's a very high level rule. And so there are going to be questions about where these leases happen, what kind of activities they involve, how they're priced, that are going to be really key and that folks should continue to be engaged in and follow.
All right. Well, thank you to the panelists and thank you to FedSoc for hosting this. And now we'll go back to FedSoc Edith Harold. Go for it.
Yeah, thank you. On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Sam, Jeff, and Jonathan for speaking and Jim for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise today. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your active participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.